What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
This is Talia Schlanger, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio.
Yellow walls are lined with portraits, and I got my new red fetching leather jacket. All these poses, such beautiful poses, makes any boy feel like picking up roses.
That's the absolutely unmistakable voice of Rufus Wainwright. The song is Poses. It's the title track from his second album. You could say that musical craftsmanship was Wainwright's destiny. It's certainly in his DNA. He was born to folk royalty, son of singer-songwriters Loudon Wainwright III and Kate McGarrigle. His sister Martha is also a compelling musician. Rufus Wainwright was playing piano by the time he was six and touring as a member of the McGarrigle sisters and family when he was only 13. So it's no surprise that he broke through early. Rolling Stone named Rufus Wainwright Best New Artist for his self-titled debut album. He went on to record 9 more studio albums and 5 live albums. He's won Juno Awards and been nominated for Grammys. He's been honored by GLAAD and has poured his gifts into numerous genres, from pop to standards and even opera. That's Oh, Madame Saint Laurent from Rufus's opera, Prima Donna. He's also an unabashed lover of theater and of the legendary Judy Garland.
All the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for me.
That's Almost Like Being in Love from Rufus's 2007 live album, Rufus Does Judy at Carnegie Hall. The songs Rufus performs are so wide-ranging and demanding. I was curious to hear how he prepares on show day.
Yeah, I just got off a fairly long European tour. I would say, you know, especially when you're in Europe and you're going, you know, to a different country every day, that usually entails, you know, trying to get some sense of where you are and maybe taking a walk, you know, around the beautiful part of the place that you are playing. But other than that, you know, I think what I most enjoy doing just on a more kind of musical level is, you know, I write songs all the time. And if I can get into a mode where I'm writing backstage, I kind of get lost in that process. On one hand, it also, it warms up my voice because I'm just sort of, you know, singing repetitively. But then also, I have this strange thing where oftentimes I will come up with an amazing lyric, or what I think is an amazing lyric, right before I have to go on stage. It's like a strange little cosmic sort of thing that happens. And so I'm always shocked at, like, right before I have to, you know, jump onto the stage, this like melody will come or this lyric will come. And it's kind of, you know, the muses playing tricks on me a bit. So
they're like, here you go. Now you can't work on this idea. Now you gotta go entertain the people.
Yeah, yeah. It happens quite regularly. So
wait, so what do you do with it then?
I very quickly, you know, grab my phone and record it and then run out. But it's odd how that happens almost regularly if I am writing before a show.
I'm sort of knocked out that you have the energy to write before a show.
Yeah. And then often I'll finish the show and come back and I'll continue writing. I mean, it's not always like that, but I go through periods like that. And actually my band are a little bit shocked. They're like, this guy just, somebody turn him off. He's going to disintegrate.
It's kind of unbelievable because performing is exhausting. It's so demanding. Yeah, and then writing, you're sort of, are you asking for energy from a different part of yourself?
Yeah, it's a different part of yourself. And also it's my happy place. You know, what can I say? I mean, it sure beats, you know, watching the news on the bus, you know, to continue that cosmic journey through, you know, lyrics and music.
I want to drill down a little bit more on the writing process. Like you said, muses. Do you believe, is there a sort of spiritual component or an otherworldly component to ideas dropping into your head?
Yes, yes. Well, speaking with Talia, who of course is one of the muses. Yeah, no, I have a kind of witchy, you know, belief and inspiration and, you know, coming up with these ideas and characters that kind of speak to you from another world and need to be manifested and so forth. I strongly believe in that kind of pagan ritual, you know, of summoning the muses, yes.
What needs to be in place for you to be able to summon them? Like, is there a part of your life that you have to be active in order for that connection to be there?
You just have to ask, you know, you just have to summon them. And it really doesn't take that long. I mean, I'm very lucky to have this because some artists don't. But I have often found that if I really sit down and I say, look, I got to write this song, you know, send me a message, I am usually rewarded pretty quickly. Maybe it's not, you know, a masterpiece or anything, but I don't know. There's this, I have a very good relationship with the creative forces for some reason. I have good karma or something. For instance, you know, my sister just wrote a book, Martha Wainwright. She wrote a book about a sort of a memoir called, I think it's called Stories I Might Regret Telling You or something. And it's doing quite well. And I've written things occasionally. That is the complete opposite. If I have to write prose and sit down and, you know, compose a sort of story, that's like pulling teeth for me.
I'm wondering also, like, so there are these ideas that come from wherever they come from, but then there's the actual work, like the mechanics of sitting down and giving physical form to an idea, which is like a massive amount of work. Do you ever have a day where you're like, I don't want to do that?
If I have to do it, I do it, but it isn't, I don't know. I mean, I'm someone who, maybe because I've had, you know, rather reckless tendencies in the past, you know, wanting to go out and wanting to kind of lose myself in, you know, the dark recesses of the world occasionally. Therefore, I've always had a lot of projects on the go, whether it's musicals or operas or making records. And that does also, you know, that gets me out of my head and just allows me, you know, it's wholesome in the end.
Keeps you out of trouble.
yeah, keeps me out of trouble. There you go.
That's fair. Well, I'm wondering, like, you put out a new album a couple of years ago, and when I think about your evolution as a songwriter, I'm wondering how you think that you've changed as a songwriter over time, maybe since you were engaging in some of those dark recesses.
Yeah, I mean, certainly every song that I've written, I try to write it as if I've never written a song before, you know? Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there are, you know, themes that arise that I've worked with. And there does seem to be kind of types of songs that I write that are in these, like, compartments. I really try to make it a blank slate at the outset. I think when you do it so much and for so many different types of projects, you do have to sort of, you know, you have to be able to get super zen about it at the outset. And then, you know, then it takes the form that it will take. I mean, if I was a pop songwriter, you know, and that does exist, you know, there are, especially in Los Angeles, I mean, there's whole teams of people who churn out these pop hits, and they there's a real formula to it and a real kind of like desire to, you know, hit a market and stuff. That is a big job. I cannot do that.
Why is it? Like, how is what you are doing different than than what that is?
Well, because I'm going to, you know, for me, it's a spiritual, I'm not saying that other people don't have a spiritual connection to their songwriting, but mine is wholly so, you know, in the sense that like when I'm writing a song, I'm not thinking about any other artist singing it. I'm not thinking about, you know, what's on the radio. I'm not thinking about what the kids want to hear or what's, you know, popular at the moment. It's like totally devoid of anything like that. And I'm not necessarily proud of this. It's just how I do it, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the journey that I take. And people seem to react well to it, you know?
Well, it's kind of always been that way. Like, if I'm, as you're saying this, I'm thinking 1998, you put out your debut album. The biggest albums that year were like The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, like hip hop, R&B, soul, Mezzanine, Massive Attack. The grunge era had just come, and that was all about people pretending that they weren't putting effort into anything. Did you have any sense or any care about how you were fitting in at that time?
I had no idea what was happening on many levels. I just wanted to write a really great song. I mean, I was very, and still am, you know, dedicated to the classics of songwriting, whether it's, you know, the classic American songbook or, you know, German Lieder or, you know, opera and or you know, great American musicals. And I just wanted to write something that was kind of arresting as those works can be, you know. And a lot of that music, you know, when like Nirvana came out and stuff, I just, it's not that I didn't like it or that I didn't get it. I just didn't, it just wasn't in my purview, which is funny because I ended up going to LA and hanging out with Courtney Love. Like, I knew all those people. I was in that scene, but I was in my own little bubble doing my own little thing. And thankfully I had the support to do that with DreamWorks Records and stuff. So,
yeah, you said that you wanted to write the great song or that you were on the hunt for something. Yeah. Was there a first song that came out of you that you were like, oh, okay, I can do this?
Well, I mean, the one that's most sort of seminal is this song, Beauty Mark, that I wrote about my mother early on, and it's on my first album. I'd written a bunch of songs that were kind of all over the place. And my mother told me that. She said, you know, you got to really tighten this up a little bit here because I don't think people are going to want to listen to this too much.
We should say, like, she was an amazing folk singer, Kate McGarrigle.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, Kate McGarrigle, great. Yeah, legendary folk
singer. She wasn't
just
like some mom who was like,
no,
oh,
no, no,
you can do
no,
better.
No, yeah. No, no, no. She was very intent on really, you know, giving me a solid education and therefore was pretty critical of both my sister and I. But so I wrote Beauty Mark as a kind of reply to her. And she loved that song. And she kind of liked every song after that, pretty much, except for a few exceptions.
And she'd tell you those?
Oh, yeah. No, she would let me know.
So you write that song early on and you like sort of mentioned that when you were writing at that time in your early career, there was a big lifestyle that was going along with it, partying, having a lot of fun. How did you balance that with the actual craft of like sitting down at the piano and doing what you were doing?
Yeah. Well, it all came together, you know, it was all done at the same time. I mean, my great saving grace, and it is true, is that I was never able to really perform when I was screwed up. Like drinking and singing on stage just did not work for me. I immediately, you know, my tuning faltered and my, you know, piano playing, I'd make mistakes and stuff. So I had to have a line and sort of a border there that I was thankfully I had. But when I wrote and stuff at home, you know, I could do whatever the hell I wanted, you know, and I very much, you know, kind of would go to a party and then get back at dawn and then, you know, write more. And
Beauty Mark is such a raw song, as so many of your songs are. I'm wondering, like, as a writer, was it always comfortable for you to go to a place like that and write with that much honesty?
Yeah. No, it was, look, I had, there was never any choice otherwise. I mean, and that's more of a family tradition. I mean, if you look at my dad's music, Loudon Wainwright, or my mother, or my sister Martha, I mean, we've always imbued our material with, you know, blood. And for better or for worse, I mean, it's been somewhat of a rocky road. But that was begun by our parents. So yeah, we're just continuing a tradition, and it's working for the time being. I don't know if our kids will go into music and do that as well, but who knows?
I read somewhere that your parents put you to sleep like in a guitar case when you were a baby.
Yes.
Is that actually folk fairy tale or is that true?
No, that's true. And I have a photograph. Yeah, no, my mother was in the hospital. You know, she had me and then they were driving her home. But before going home, she went to see my dad in the studio and there was no crib there. So they put me in the guitar case. And that was my first ever crib outside of the hospital was a guitar case. Yeah.
And your parents, I understand, split when you were 3 years old.
Yeah, I was three. Yeah.
What did you understand about it at that time, or how did they explain it to you?
I didn't really understand it at all. But the one sort of memory that I have that stuck with me was wondering why they were putting the dining room table in the back of a truck.
Oh.
like that didn't really make much sense to me. But yeah, so I remember that. And yeah, no, it was a very tough divorce for everybody, for both my parents and also for my sister and I. And we do write about it. You know, we do communicate these stories. I think people appreciate that. But yet, as I said, it comes at a price as well, because, you know, the lines can be blurred between, you know, the stage and the kitchen.
That's for sure. I mean, yeah. It kind of blows my mind to think about having a mom who's working at communicating her feelings about your family life on stage to audiences while you're growing up.
Yeah.
In it. Like, can you give me a sense of what it was like to grow up with a songwriter for both parents?
Yeah, I mean, it was, there's just a language that we could all, you know, understand, and that was wonderful to communicate in. And look, in the end of the day, it got our feelings out, and we were able to be passionate and sort of loving and, you know, exciting people because, you know, we had good lighting.
How did you fall in love with musicals? Like, your parents were both folk musicians, so where did the love of musicals come from?
I would visit my dad and we would go see musicals and
in New York.
New York.
Yeah,
he was in New York and we'd go to Annie and Barnum and Cats and stuff. So it was really through him. And then I developed a real passion for Cole Porter, especially, and those very famous, the Ella Fitzgerald records when she would do the songbook albums, you know.
Classic American
Lawrence
songbook,
and Hart. Yeah. And so I would listen to those songs, which were often from musical shows, and then do a little research here and there.
I would think that somebody like with a love of musicals and theater and all that, and with also the widely emotional voice that you have with so much range to it, could have thought about pursuing theater as a career. Did you ever think about that?
I mean, I wanted to write the material, but I am writing. I mean, I've written a musical now that will actually be premiered in about a year or so. I can't really say anything about it, but yes, I am definitely aiming.
I want to know everything about it.
I know. And it's a great story, and it's with a great sort of team, and you will know more about it. But I mean, certainly now, you know, with the Judy Garland shows, celebrating her 100th birthday and singing a lot of those, you know, classic musical songs. And also, I mean, with her especially, I was like just head over heels in love with movie musicals. You know, for me, I didn't want to be on, you know, the stage necessarily in a musical. I wanted to be on a sound stage, you know, with, you know, thousands of people surrounding me and, you know, fountains and thunderclaps and everything. So that was sort of more what I was susceptible to.
Well, there's the glamour of it, but there's also, I think, the music. Like, what was it about the music that Judy Garland sang that made you want to take it on?
Yeah. Well, I think with her especially, it was this insane, and I'm speaking about her movies now and the musicals, this insane kind of laser beam of strength that where all of these elements suddenly were mushed together, you know, whether it was her incredible singing, an incredible song, the great lighting. I mean, the light, even though I say lighting in a kind of funny way, though, you can't, but that Hollywood lighting was just so otherworldly, and then the great costumes and the great choreographer, and it would all come together in this sort of blinding ray of light and just devastate anyone who even came within, you know, an inch of it. So I was very seduced by that. And of course, the music was really top of the list. I mean, in the sense that that songwriters at that time, and a lot of them did write musicals, you know, Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and all of those guys, is that they were really celebrated as these, they were considered gods in a lot of ways. And, yeah. And when I say gods, I mean like gods and goddesses, more Greek style, to what everybody did. It had to be just so seductive and so powerful and so kind of just undeniable in a lot of ways.
There was a sense of occasion about everything that I think.
Yeah, yeah. And I think to be on stage or to be on the film on screen, you know, you had to be larger than life.
Yeah. Musician Rufus Wainwright. If you love conversations with powerful songwriters, check out our episode with Carly Simon.
I had developed my own voice, but with so many influences that I hadn't cut myself off from my influences and made a whole me. The umbilical cord was still attached to Odetta, was still attached to Annie Ross of Lambert, Henriksen and Ross, still attached to Pete Seeger, to the various influences. I mean, I still have trouble with that.
Hear the rest of the conversation with Carly Simon at heresthething.org. After the break, Rufus shares the special something it takes to do justice to Judy Garland.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Talia Schlanger, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. That is, of course, Somewhere Over the Rainbow from Rufus Wainwright's new live album, Rufus Does Judy at Capitol Studios. Wainwright's music often features big, luscious instrumentation, which makes this gorgeous a cappella moment particularly unique.
There's a story behind that, and what it is that, I mean, that was a song that my mother and I did together since I was a very young child.
Oh.
And when I first did the big, you know, tribute shows at Carnegie Hall and at the Palladium in London, you know, we had a big orchestra and everything. And I, for that number particularly, I had my mother come out and accompany me just for the beginning, you know, and then the strings would come in and the band, and it would, you know, become more like the original. But there was just sort of this nice moment of with the two of us. And then sadly, you know, she passed away from cancer at 63. And
So
in a lot of ways, that's sort of me, you know, that's her, me and her together.
Oh, do you mean that you're sort of like marking her absence by having those lines
marking
without her?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's what it is. Yeah.
You can feel that. Like, I mean, I think I know many people who have emotional connections to that song for whatever reason,
but you
can really feel a presence of something.
Yeah,
so
yeah. No, that song, I mean, look, it's been done 8 billion times in 8 billion different ways. But it's amazing how powerful it is and how, you know, how it just, it's the gift that keeps giving, for sure.
Yeah. Did you perform this album for an audience of one for Renee Zellweger?
Yes, I did.
So what's it like to perform just for one person versus thousands?
Well, this was a COVID measure, you know.
Okay.
You know, it stemmed from a series of shot concerts that I did from my living room during COVID when all my tours were canceled and I just did shows here. We would have like a celebrity guest for each one. And so it was part of that series. And
so did Renee win a raffle? Is that how she ended up sitting in
We won, Renee.
Yeah.
We won the raffle and Renee arrived. Really, actually we did, because we would ask a lot of people and some people could, some people couldn't, some people didn't want to, you know, be anywhere during COVID. So it was, we were very fortunate to have her. And she was totally gracious and I think really enjoyed it a lot. And she was going to maybe sing at one point, but then it didn't really make sense because she'd just done Judy and she'd won the Oscar for it. And and it was sort of like, I think she was ready to like be a spectator, you know, she was ready to, she didn't want to kind of go back into Judy, which I totally understand, you know, move on.
Yeah. Did you and your mom connect over Judy when you were younger too, or just as a grown up?
I mean, I think she appreciated Judy Garland. I think she was also aware that it was, you know, indicative of some other things.
What do you mean?
You mean in terms of me, you know, loving Judy Garland, it's like, oh my God, you know, my son is not going to be a football player. She was nervous about a lot of that stuff, you know, that I was gay. And so I think it was accepted, but also not necessarily encouraged. She wasn't against it or anything, but it was, you know, once again, it was a different world. Being gay back in the 80s was very different. But she appreciated her artistry and she loves the song. But she was really more of a rock and roll person. My mother loved, you know, Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and people like that.
I'm curious about what it was like to come out to your mom at that time.
Yeah, no, it was intense. It was intense. I was only 13, so
wow.
So and that was very rare at that time, and AIDS was everywhere, and so it was a heavy duty time, but we got through it, thankfully.
Were you scared at that time too? Did you have an awareness?
Oh yeah, all the time. Yeah, no, I was scared shitless, you know, of what was going on with AIDS and everything, and so was everybody. It was like a very dark period, which, I mean, we're in a dark period now.
Yeah.
But yeah, the AIDS epidemic was pretty bad.
I grew up in theater and working in theater, and my first roommate was a gay guy who was in his 20s. I was 17, and he and his friends sort of showed me how to live and showed me the ropes. And we were in Toronto, which is quite different, but we, you know, I got a sense of it. We've lost friends in our friend group to complications due to HIV, and it's so real and it's so recent.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of amazing to make it out of that time safely.
Yeah, yeah. No, it is. It is. And it's somewhat of a miracle, I have to say, because I had some pretty dicey periods at certain points. But, you know, it is, look, I mean, and maybe with Judy too, and in a strange way with those songs, and also, you know, she would have been 100, you know, that June 10th is, I'm performing, you know, at City Winery for her birthday and doing some of this out, doing her, a lot of these songs. And even though she died at a very young age, and she was obviously a victim of addiction and so forth, there's something in her voice that gave a lot of strength to people and really helped soldier on through, you know, really impossible odds.
Yeah. And we need honesty from our, from our artists.
Yeah.
That's something I've always admired about your writing. Like, I'm such a long time fan of yours. And I think one thing when I was getting ready to talk to you today that I was thinking about is, like, having these really big, grand arrangements, you have to have a real emotional truth to what you're saying for that to all make sense and land and not feel over the top, like to feel real. Is that something you think about in your writing?
Well, I have to say with this album, I strongly believe that is one of its greatest assets, is that this whole Judy, you know, phantasmagoria beforehand with the Carnegie Hall and the orchestra and the, you know, the big arrangements and everything, that's great. And I love doing that, and I will do that again. But there's something in paring it all down and really going back to the essentials and also really having it lean mostly on my interpretations as a singer and as an artist. There's a brutality to it, which is good. It's much more fierce. And now I've sung those songs for many years, you know, like when I made my album, the Judy album, almost 20 years ago, I didn't know a lot of that material very well, but now it's really in my body, and I just have to sort of, I could do it all a cappella.
It's hard to sing though. Like, that stuff is not easy to sing. It requires a huge range, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it requires an intelligence. Not that I'm smart really, because I'm actually quite dumb in a lot of ways, but musically, you have to sort of really, I don't know, you have to inhabit both the lyrics and the melody and sort of really interpret them in a way that the listener is very much, you know, taken away into this other world. And all those great songs have the ability to do that.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk.
Rufus Wainwright. If you're enjoying this episode, don't keep it to yourself. Tell a friend. And be sure to follow us on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we return, Rufus Wainwright shares his thoughts on how fatherhood has changed him.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Talia Schlanger, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. I'm going to a place that has already been disgraced. I'm gonna see some folks who have already been let down. I'm so tired of America.
That's Rufus Wainwright performing Going to a Town from his 2007 album, Release the Stars. Wainwright's wide-ranging style is impossible to pigeonhole. For a musician who has straddled so many styles and had such a long career, I was curious who his fans are today, who he sees when he looks out at the crowd.
Well, it depends where I am. You know, especially in Europe, I get a good sense of that, where, you know, in certain places it'll all be people my age or older, and then other places there'll be a lot of young people. Like in Spain, for instance, there's still a lot of young people who come to see me. A lot of women,
yeah.
And a lot of straight guys. The gays are a little harder to pin down, as usual.
What do you mean?
They're just a little more. They're very into the flavor of the month, you know.
More fair weather fans.
Yeah,
I see.
They're fair weather fans. I mean, they know who I am, and they come occasionally, and they've enjoyed their time, and they've noted my existence, but it's not they're not particularly loyal, which, you know, is kind of part of being a gay person sometimes. Gay man, I especially. The lesbians is the opposite. They're like the most loyal. I mean, they're with you till the bitter end.
That's interesting. Do you think that your being out has affected your career in one way or the other?
Yeah, no, very much. I mean, I think it's given me a kind of, I don't know. It's been an interesting ride. I mean, I think fundamentally I'm very happy with my decision and my story and my career and my, you know, legacy are firmly kind of established and rooted, I do think I lost a lot of opportunities along the way that could have maybe made me, I don't know, more mainstream or, you know, more, made me more money and stuff. But,
really?
But in the end of the, yeah, oh yeah, totally. But funnily enough, I think I actually dodged a bullet, because if I, you know, I'm not hounded all the time. I have privacy. I can do what I want to do. You know, I'm not sort of a slave to this show business beast that I think people who are a few notches up from me have to contend with.
Yeah.
More.
Did anybody ever try to make you keep that side of yourself down?
Oh, yeah. No, they would often say, like, oh, why don't you just pretend you're bisexual?
Oh, or, God.
Like, when I, you know, when I would say it, or that you're, or just not talk about it. I mean, oh, yeah. When I started, it was, nobody was doing it. I mean,
yeah.
It was, and I was in the mainstream. I was signed to a major label and, you know, doing big shows, and I was very honest about my sexuality, which was completely unusual at that time, especially for men. Because at that time, there were people like Melissa Etheridge and Katie Lang had kind of come out of the closet a bit. So it was kind of happening, but that was more of a sort of, how can I say this? I wouldn't say it was a thing, but it was sort of, it was less dangerous, I think, than a gay man, which is interesting. But then afterwards, you know, it became, you know, more common.
Do you think that the music industry has changed at all when it comes to welcoming people of all?
Yeah, I mean, I do actually feel that in the music business, it's more, it's, you know, with people like Lil Nas X and Troye Sivan, yeah. And yes, there's a foothold now that exists. And I think even after, you know, the death of George Michael, which was, you know, he obviously struggled so much with his demons. And so there's kind of, I don't know, it's more embedded at this point. I think in Hollywood and the acting thing, it's completely still out to lunch. I mean, why is there not one leading man who's gay? Really, like a leading man,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's not one, you know, still. And I mean, they kind of toy with it. But there, I think in Hollywood, it's in the movie business and stuff, it's still a big problem.
I'm thinking about so Schitt's Creek, this like wonderful show created by Eugene Levy and his son Dan Levy.
Yeah.
And as you're saying this, I'm thinking about the finale episode, which was considered groundbreaking, you know, in the last couple of years, where the Dan Levy's character marries a man, and it was just this really beautiful, touching wedding ceremony to watch. And Dan, did you see Dan Levy's mom's tweet? She tweeted, "Today I regret every single second of worry back in the uninformed 80s, wondering how the world was going to treat my brilliant little boy who loved to twirl. Little did I know that he was going to kick that old world's ass to the curb and create a brand new one."
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful.
Yeah. But I think that that's part of, like, I'm grateful to you for being who you are and doing it in the way that you do it, because I think it gives other people license to be themselves and to see that that's the way, like, that's not only the way to live, but that's also the way to create art. That's the way to achieve your dreams. That's the way to do all of this.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much.
It's a really beautiful thing. How, I'm curious to know if your daughter's interested in music at all now.
Yeah, no, she is. She sings and she's interested in it, but she's also interested in her nails. and her hair and her friends, and you know, it's not there's a whole wide variety of interest there.
How do you balance, like, sure, fatherhood and being there for your kid with all of these demands and also like writing before you're getting out on stage on tour, all of the stuff that you do?
Right. No, I just do it. Thankfully I have the time, and I also have the support. I mean, I have a great husband, Jorn, and who's also my manager as well. So that's really helpful, because he can really understand, you know, the tightrope that has to be walked. And once again, I mean, I'm not super famous in the sense that, you know, I can have privacy. I can have downtime. I'm not hounded. Like all those people like Lady Gaga and stuff. I mean, that in itself becomes its own job. And that to me would be this just like a bloody nightmare. So
yeah.
Did
becoming a dad yourself change the way that you think about your own dad when you were growing up?
Yeah. I mean, somewhat. But you have to try to forgive your parents regardless of whether you understand it or not.
Yeah. Is there anything that you learned from him as a dad that you want to pass on to your daughter?
He's funny. He has a good sense of humor. Yeah. Yes, he has an amazing sense of humor, actually. He really knows how to make my daughter laugh. And that's very important. And when I say laugh, I mean really laugh. He's a brilliant wit, and I admire him for that.
You've written so much about craving and longing and desire in your career.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking about the album Want One and the song Want, yeah, where you wrote,
I just want to be my dad. This light sprinkling of my mother.
What do you want now?
Now, what do I want? Good question. Well, you know, speaking of Broadway, I actually would like to conquer Broadway. It's very simple. I spent, you know, during COVID, and this idea to write this musical came up, and I did it. And now we're very much in the process of, you know, producing the theater piece and getting, you know, casting and stuff like that. And I do actually see a real opening for me in terms of really being able to gain from all the experiences I've had in the past through opera or through, you know, my love of Judy Garland. I can kind of infuse this Broadway dream with that knowledge. So I'm very excited to actually go full on ahead into that. That's what I want. I want to conquer Broadway and the West End.
Let's
just keep it simple.
Dream small. That's what they always say.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but what is it that drives you to conquer these new territories after so much time? What is it?
Well, it's funny because it's not, I never wanted to conquer, for instance, I never wanted to conquer the opera world. Hmm. And I didn't. I mean, I wrote two very beautiful operas and they've done very well and they're very appreciated and they're being produced. But it's not like, I'm not like the leading composer of opera or anything. And in terms of singing the Judy stuff, I just did that because I thought it would be fun. But with the Broadway West End stuff, that I do want to conquer. That is a more of a blood sport. So I'm embarking on that journey now. I already have, actually. So,
well, I'm going to wish you well with it. I cannot wait to hear what comes of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you.
My thanks to singer, songwriter, and opera composer Rufus Wainwright. You can see him live all over the U.S. and Europe in 2022. And if you're in New York, you can catch him at City Winery. He has 4 dates there starting June 5th. I'll leave you with Rufus's ode to love in the modern world. This is Vibrate from Want One. I'm Talia Schlanger. Alec Baldwin will be back next week. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeartRadio.
My phone's on vibrate for you. God knows what all these new drugs do. I guess to have no more fears, but still I
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.